Welcome, everyone, to the Mona Charon Show. I am delighted to welcome this week my friend, Holly Berkeley Fletcher, who has a very interesting life story, which is part of what we're going to talk about today, and also is the author of a great new book, The Missionary Kids, Unmasking the Myths of White Evangelicalism. Holly, thank you so much for being here.
Well, you know, I'm thrilled. I'm the official Bulwark superfan. So this is such a thrill.
Well, I'm stepping on eggshells here because, you know, I'm afraid that I might do something with that will then get incorporated into one of your parodies of us.
The next one's overdue, I must say.
So they're delightful. All right. So let's start with your life story. When we first met, you told me that you were the child of missionaries and grew up in Africa. You served your country in the CIA for many years, recently retired. You were an analyst. So when I heard this, I thought, you know, it's there's something sort of old fashioned about it, about being the child of missionaries in 2021. You know, my mind goes back to famous, you know, children of missionaries of the past. So Pearl Buck.
Yeah.
Right. John Hersey, Thornton Wilder, Henry Luce, maybe
That's
most
right.
famously.
That's right.
The founder of Time and Life and all those things. But it is an ongoing thing. And you've interviewed something like 80 other people who've had this experience. So tell us, to set the scene, tell us about where, you know, how you came to grow up in Kenya.
Yeah, well, if I can first just make a link to those famous missionary kids that you mentioned and myself. There's a great book by historian David Hollinger, emeritus of Berkeley, called Protestants Abroad. And he documents the tremendous influence that missionaries and MKs had for a long time on American thought about the international order and foreign policy. But he and I agree that there is a dramatic shift after World War II in terms of who the missionaries were. And that was from a more mainline liberal theological framework to the white, what we know now as white evangelicalism. So after World War II, the liberals sort of ceded the stage to white evangelicals, and therefore the influence of missionaries and MKs became of a rather different flavor, and the type of missions that took place became different as well. So I just wanted to make that connection. And my life story connects with that evangelical tradition. My parents were Southern Baptist missionaries, and the Southern Baptists are by far the most active. They have the largest, most sophisticated, most active mission board that in human history, there's never been anything like it. And that's what my parents were part of. And interestingly enough, the Southern Baptists formed as a denomination in order to do missions, and specifically in order to do missions with slaveholders. So that's kind of an interesting part of the story too.
Wait, so yeah, let's delve into that. Explain the origin story here.
Yeah, so first of all, American missions really began in earnest in the 19th century as part of the, you know, the Second Great Awakening and just the founding of America and this idea of American exceptionalism and really the optimism of the time and what people imagined America's sort of God-ordained role in the world would be. And so missions became wildly popular beginning in the early part of the 19th century. And for the Baptists, they had a national mission board that was also in cooperation with the British. And the British were also active in the missions movement at that time. But they, as the slavery issue became more and more divisive, the Southerners mounted a test case and put up a slaveholder to be appointed as a missionary, and the and sort of forcing the issue on the mission board. And the mission board decided they would not appoint a slaveholder as a missionary to go overseas or to Native Americans. That was the other mission field at the time. And so the Southern Baptists, that was the origin of the split, is so that they could form their own mission board. And so that was the beginning of the Southern Baptist Convention, and it was the beginning of their mission board as well.
So they would enslave people at home and try to save the souls Yep. of people abroad.
Yep.
Okay.
And I mean, one of the arguments of the book is that, you know, this is no accident in terms of how missions have functioned for white American Christians. It's been a bit of an escapist hatch, especially on the race issue. And still functions that way in many ways, although it's a lot more subtle. But, you know, you can go and have, you know, interactions with people of color elsewhere that are in which you are sort of more, there's less emotional baggage, mm-hmm. and you can remain sort of the good guys.
And you present yourself as this benevolent donor and helper
correct.
And all that.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And meanwhile, here at home, you're not dealing, you know, again, the history of missions goes right along with it. It really became very, very popular in the late 19th and early 20th century, again, at the same time that the lynching crisis was happening and Jim Crow was being established. And, you know, and again, the Southern Baptists, who were at the forefront of those activities, were also a major force in missions. And to this day, the Southern Baptists are a major force in missions and still is not the best, shall we say, at dealing with America's racial history. So it's an interesting dichotomy that's maybe not so coincidental in my estimation.
Right. So you have a pretty harsh take on what these missions are. So in the name of fairness, let's talk about what good have they done? What are some of the positive aspects of it?
Yeah. So I say in the book, and I think the historical record shows that the sort of more secular narrative of missions is also inaccurate, where missions are like these colonial powers that go in and like change the culture and so on and so forth. And I think that's oversimplified as well. In the early days of missions, the missionaries were in a very vulnerable position and often dependent on these local communities. They depended on, in Bible translation and so on, local people
partners.
Had to be involved in translating the Bible. And in fact, a lot of these Bible translation efforts helped write down and preserve language, some of these languages as well. You know, missionaries brought education to a lot of places. And in fact, educated a lot of the nationalist leaders that then went on to mount the independence movements. I know that's true in a lot of parts of Africa as well. Missionaries, in some cases, worked against harmful, you know, cultural practices like India's caste system, or in Africa, female genital mutilation, things like that. So it's not the narrative of missions in terms of what they've accomplished in the world. You know, it's really not my purpose to make a judgment either way, good or bad, because I think there is both. And then, and even now with individual, I know many missionaries who do good work now. My main, critique, is the place of missions for white American Christians and how they have used missions to inflate their sense of their own sense of God ordination, their own sense of self-esteem and arrogance, and to avoid and escape their own sins. And I think that dynamic is very much at play to this day.
So they can tell themselves, even if I have a bad track record or my community has a poor track record on racial justice here at home, can't criticize us because look what we're doing in Africa. Is that the idea?
That's right. And not just race either. It's this idea of like, you know, missions have been central to a white evangelical heroic narrative of we're, you know, sort of the chosen people, you know, we're needed by God to rescue the culture, to promote, you know, obviously the right kind, you know, Christianity, but not just that, the right kind of Christianity to sort of save the world. And you see that narrative now in MAGA and the white evangelical view of MAGA. So missions has been really central to building that narrative. And what I detail in the book too is that, you know, the children, the missionary kids, have often sort of paid the price of that because, you know, when a missionary kid is abused or just their needs aren't met or something like that, the narrative that we grow up with is like, oh, this work is so important, you know, to God and to the salvation of the world, literally the salvation of the world, you know, like you just, you know, kind of don't rock the boat. Like you can't, you don't deal with the abuse. Don't expose the abuse. A lot of bad things happen on the mission field that are swept under the rug. And it's an extension of what happens here as well with, for instance, the Southern Baptist Convention sexual abuse crisis, for instance, and not dealing with that. This idea that, you know, well, we can't let this out because, you know, it'll diminish the work of the Lord in the world. And well, in fact,
that's something institutions do all the time. The Catholic Church did the same thing.
Absolutely. The Catholic Church did the same thing. And you could argue that the Republican Party has done the same thing of late. Yeah. Institutions do that all the time. I think when it's a religious institution and culture, you put the divine ordained sheen on it. And it does tend to up the ante a bit.
So you said it beautifully in your book. I actually flagged this page, I'm just gonna read this paragraph because I think it's exactly, you captured this whole thing. You say, you know, I get it's not our job as parents to remove all hardships from our children's lives, and you say, you know, kids need a certain amount of resilience. But you say, on the other hand, I'm talking about deliberately putting children in physically or emotionally dangerous circumstances that can inhibit their healthy maturation. And even more, I'm talking about spiritualizing that abuse to the point where they can't even name it properly. They aren't allowed to because it's bathed in the blood of Jesus.
Right.
And that was just, you read that and think, whoa. I mean, that, because of course, you know, you tell many stories of children who, and some of your data, by the way, 53% of those you spoke to reported abuse, not necessarily sexual abuse, but some kind of abuse.
Or neglect. Growing up. I think it was abuse or neglect, I'm not mistaken. Or they witnessed abuse or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is just unbelievable. And that's a very, very high number. And they feel that if they say something, and that's what's such a really painful trap, that they are not just betraying perhaps their family, but also betraying God.
That's right. Or risking having to leave, you know, that's another big motivation is if you sort of stick your head up, if the family is having trouble, if you are having trouble as a child, the mission board could send you home, you know, as they say, although for missionary kids, home is not really the United States, and having to leave, you know, your friends and your country and everything that you've known just abruptly like that is something that, you know, I think we all grew up really dreading, and definitely does inhibit, you know, sticking your head up or raising your hand or saying that you're struggling in any way.
So I guess I thought, and maybe many people would imagine, that if you grow up in a foreign country as the child of missionaries, that you were integrated into a different culture, that you went to school with kids from that country and so on. But you described something entirely different, that actually these mission kids grow up in little bubbles, little curated bubbles, where they're getting a white evangelical Christian worldview inculcated, and they get well, talk about it. Did you have much interaction with Kenyan kids when you were growing up?
Well, you know, there's obviously some variety here, but I would say that the sort of living primarily in a sort of insular missionary world is probably the dominant lifestyle amongst evangelical missionaries. Some of it is, if you're in the developing world, which is where a lot of missionaries are, there's a huge, you know, socioeconomic gap in addition to any kind of racial, cultural gap. You're living in these little privileged islands. Very few families live on the level of the community and very few families really can become part of the community. So I think my experience was pretty representative. I did go to a Kenyan primary school for a couple of years, a local Kenyan primary school. You know, it was on the nice end. It was like the sort of middle class Kenyan kids, but it was a Kenyan school in a small, you know, now the town is really big. I was just there, but it was a small town at the time, or a smaller town. And, you know, I was one of just a few white children. And that experience, but even then, like I was privileged. The teachers treated us special. We got special privileges that the other children didn't get. And you're a minority, but what you're kind? A very privileged minority.
What you mean the Kenyan teachers?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what kind There's of privileges?
Some of the teachers were European or American as well, but the Kenyan teachers definitely. Well, one of them, which I just think really makes me angry now, is I didn't have to study Swahili. During Swahili class, I was allowed to read a book or do something else because they didn't think that it was right to have me study Swahili. And of course, now I've worked really hard as an adult to, you know, become fluent in Swahili. And I was like, well, gee, that would have been nice, you know?
Yeah.
So that's just one example. Or just, you know, we got away with more things. We got sort of, you know, we were like buddies with the headmistress. And there was definitely a privileging of us that were there. And you see that at least now it's a little different in urban settings with a middle class educated class of Africans, where there's even a hostility. There's an awareness of kind of the colonial mindset and even a hostility. But you go out in rural areas even now to this day, or you kind of get away from those more educated circles, and there is such a difference. There's it's hard to escape. Like even when you're really pushing back against it, it's hard to escape the deference that certainly Americans have over there. So I went to a Kenyan school, but again, it wasn't like I was, you know, one of the people exactly. But then when I was 10, I went to an American run boarding school that was really an island to itself. Now there's a huge fence around it. It's literally a walled off little city.
Can you tell the story of how you persuaded your parents to let you go? Because you were you were too young, right?
I was too young, although many children and many of my classmates went even in first grade. I mean, can you imagine dropping your 6-year-old off? And there were no phones and there was no communication really. And some of them, you dropped their 6-year-old off and didn't see them for 3 months at a time, and with no communication. So I was 10, which was too young, given that I had this good option in the town where we lived. It was a good school and I was doing well. There was no reason why I should go to school. But my older sister had gone to the boarding school. She was the primary school. She was too old to go to the school that I went to. It didn't go up to her grade. And so she had gone the year before. And, you know, I idolized her. I wanted to be like her. I thought she was cool. She was my best friend. And I wanted to go, I wanted to be like her. And I wanted to go to the school with her. And so I did what my dad did, apparently, to test his own calling. There was a method, it's probably still used, I don't know, but back then it was really prevalent, where you stand your Bible up and you let it fall open. And then you close your eyes and you kind of pressed your finger on the page. And that's the verse that, so if you're trying to make a big decision, or I call it the magic eight ball method of biblical discipleship or whatever. But so I did that. And the first couple of verses I got were just wildly inappropriate. I use a little bit of literary license in the book. I don't remember exactly which verses they were, but they were odd verses. They were, they were wildly inappropriate. And then the third time I got a verse, which there are a lot of verses in the Bible, by the way, in this, both the Hebrew scripture and in our New Testament, that tell you to go. You know, there's lots of go, being commanded to go. So I got a go verse, and I showed my dad and told him that God, you know, told my parents that God was calling me to go to this school, and they bought it. And so I went very young, way too young. We all agree now. So 10 years old.
So you say that these mission schools and these mission situations in general are ripe for abuse. And part of that is because the kids, well, I guess this was pre, you know, cameras and cell phones and all of that, in your case, but it's that you separate kids from their parents. So that's the first thing. Yeah. And then, there are a lot of people, well, I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like missions attract a range of types. And some of the types that they attract are people with, you know, pure hearts and, you know, who want to do good in the world. But there's also a bunch who are working out their own issues.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So talk about that.
So yeah, you're separating kids from their parents. You do have, not only do you have a range of individuals, but you have a real hodgepodge of organizations with better or worse, you know, internal accountability structures. Although honestly, in my day, there were none. I mean, it was terrible across the board. Nowadays, there are better and worse accountability mechanisms and screenings for hiring people and things like that. And then there's just there's a lot of independent missionaries that just go. They just get churches to support them. Particularly if you're charismatic, you can kind of go around and do that. And they just go. And so you have that. And then you have a culture, again, that is the narrative of missions is that these are saints. And this is sort of the highest form. Yeah. Like the parents, but also the culture around it. Like this is such important work again with salvation
saving
of
souls.
Humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these are the cream of the crop in terms of like spirituality. You're told that about your parents. You're told that about other missionaries. And, you know, that was a big reason why there's no accountability structure. You don't need accountability when you're dealing with saints, right?
So then the
sort of last, and then you have the cultural element where, you know, here in America, we obviously child abuse happens all the time, but all of us are live within systems and networks and communities of institutions of accountability. We send our kids to schools and they don't care who we are. They're mandated by the law to look after our children. You know, your neighbors don't have any deference for you. If they see something fishy, like they'll call Child Protective Services on you. But as an American living in particularly the developing world, you're really on a plane above. And again, the deference shown by the community. And then you have finally the legal, the rule of law or the lack thereof, in the country, in these countries, a lot of them don't have good rule of law. They don't even have good concepts of what child abuse is. And before 2003, there was no U.S. jurisdiction. Now, since 2003, a law was passed that allows Americans who commit child abuse overseas to be prosecuted under federal law. So that's been a huge impetus for change, actually. Survivors and advocates told me that. But still, there's a lot of legal loopholes. There's a lot of wiggle room. I in talking to the different mission agencies about the 2003 law and their practices, there seemed to be a lot of confusion about reporting and how to report and who to report to. So I don't think it's adequate by any means at all. But yeah, there's a lot of reasons why abuse can thrive on the mission field.
So among the kids, well, they're now adults, but the people who were children of missionaries that you spoke to, what percentage would you say felt that they had been, that it was overall a negative experience, and what percent not, or a positive one?
I think most people, that's a loaded question for people, you know, like, most people have a mixture of experiences, but at bottom, it's tied to who you are as a person to make an assessment of your childhood. So most missionary kids and surveys that I've seen, you know, I wouldn't trade my childhood. You know, like, how could I? You know, it's like saying you regret a marriage that didn't work out, but you have a child from that marriage. So how can you say you really, you know what I'm saying? Something like that. It's sort of akin to that. So I think, you know, there was a mixture of a range of experiences, but I think most people would say they valued their childhood, and they wouldn't change it, you know, because that's who they are. Some people did tell me, like, they hated the whole thing and they wish they had never, because it was that traumatic for them.
So I don't know if this is mostly you and your feelings, or if you were speaking for others as well, but there is a sense in your book of a terrible feeling of loss, that you had a feeling of, you know, after you finished your high school education and you're going to be shipped back to the United States to sink or swim here, that you had lost something, that there was no retrieving it. And it was it's much stronger than the way most people feel about leaving high school, for example.
Yeah.
So what is that about? Why is it that you felt like you were just losing your whole world after you came back here?
Yeah, no, that's probably the dominant thing, like, across the board, whatever the people I talked to felt about missions, or whatever their current, you know, I spoke to people who were they were missionaries themselves, or they were still very much evangelical. I spoke to people who were, you know, had thrown all that in the away and didn't want to have anything to do with it. But across the board, this is what, this is the dominant thing that came out, is this tremendous grief that people carry. I think it's about not being, because being, feeling belonging in such a specific context, it's just really not transferable. So it's not really American, but it's not really the country. You're never really part of the country where you grow up. And you're not really able to sort of carry that with you, you know, like, I'm not a Kenyan. Therefore, like, you know, like, if I were a Kenyan who immigrated to the United States, I would immediately probably find other Kenyans in the area, or go down to Swahili Village, downtown Washington, DC, and hang out and meet up with a lot of other Kenyans, you know, and I could be well integrated into this community. And I love meeting other Kenyans, but when I do, like, it's clearly not the same. Like, I did not grow up as a Kenyan. I grew up in a very rarefied bubble world that is hard for them to really relate to. I can relate to them on some things, but not other things. And yeah, so I think that's what it is it's a loss of identity, because it was so discrete. You can't really carry it with you. You basically have to start over. Then you're just supposed to be an American like everyone
else. How were you taught to think about America when you were growing up?
Well, you know, actually, on a surface level, like, very patriotic, you know, rah, 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 you know, kind of the dumb, just how white evangelicals think about it now. And then just on my own observation, you know, I was proud to be an American. USAID, actually watching USAID and the signs, the USAID signs with the flags and the food bags and all that, that gave me an enormous sense of pride. You know, I had a sense
of
pride.
Well, that's all over.
Yeah. I know that's one of the reasons why the demise of USAID has really hit me very hard, is because I remember what that looked like, you know, to myself, but also to the people that we lived around, you know, and what that meant to them. So I had this sort of patriotism or pride, but I also didn't really, and I liked going back to America. We went back a few times, and I liked going back for brief visits. You know, it was like kind of the land of candy and blue jeans. We didn't have much in the way of material goods over there. And so we would go on these big shopping sprees, and we would eat Mexican food and go get, you know, candy bars and all of these things, and seeing my grandparents, and because we didn't, you know, didn't see them for years at a time, and all of those things. But then I wanted to leave. Like, I had to go to school briefly here for a couple times, and it was just like, I hated it. Like, I just felt so out of place. I didn't want to be here. And then I didn't want to come back, you know, to, but there was no other option. Like, what was I going to do there? You know, I wasn't a Kenyan. I had this American education. So there was really no way to stay. There was no real option to stay. And so you don't have a choice. And then you're just, now you're just an American, and you look like an American, and you sound like an American, but you just have this hole that is, you know, you're sort of begging people to somehow see you, and also wanting to fit in at the same time. So it was a long, long time before I felt normal in this country.
And you, so you talk, oh, by the way, James Dobson died this week.
Oh boy.
Was he like a figure that you, that, you know, was revered in your community when you were growing up?
Absolutely. My parents modeled everything they did as parents on him.
Wow.
And then as I got older, and they would talk to me about, you know, when I became a parent, you know, they emphasized to me that you have to spank your children. Like, otherwise they will just, you know, you have to use corporal punishment. You have to basically beat their will into submission and in a respect. So yes, absolutely. That's how we were all raised. And that's how our school did not use corporal punishment by the time I got there, but it had used it in the past. And they definitely had the discipline structure was pretty authoritarian. And he was he had a huge influence, and well beyond the fringes of sort of, you know, crazy evangelicalism. You know, I went to a PCA church here in Washington that is considered a more like kind of, I don't know if you knew Tim Keller in New York City.
I met him once, actually. Yeah.
So our church was modeled after his church. So it was a kind of like an intellectual kind of, you know, of that mold, not your crazy, you know, right wingish stuff. But I was in the mom's group there, and we read a book, not James Dobson, but by another guy. And it was the same thing. It was basically like, the only Christian way to raise your children is you have to use corporal punishment, and just ignoring all the other research that is out there. So I think Dobson, and that's just on discipline. I was also given his book when I went through puberty, you know, the shame around sex and masturbation, the misogyny, like it's all, that's how I was raised.
You should dwell for a second on some of the messaging about girls and sex, teacups, ceramic mugs, styrofoam. Talk about that. I mean, that's.
Yeah. So I include a story of a girl that went to my school, but later. And let me say, I'm Gen X, and Gen X got all the purity culture, but it wasn't formalized. By the time the millennials came along, it was a whole curriculum with rituals and products and, you know, books.
Purity rings and things.
That's right. And purity balls and all of that. So we certainly got the message, you know, that, you know, I felt like having premarital sex was probably the worst thing I could ever do, you know, like up there with like murder or something. But it wasn't as formalized as what.
Can I just interrupt really quick? Because it reminds me of a story that the late Cato Byrne used to tell about the nuns that were her teachers. And how the girls later would talk about how the nuns had their priorities a little off. They would say, you know, that you had to dress a certain way because you could get murdered or worse, raped.
Yeah. And they'd both probably be your fault, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. So, and the message that it's on the girls to really police the situation was definitely something that I grew up with as well, but it really became much more formalized. And so this, this young woman that, spoke to me, and I included her story in the book, you know, by the time she went through my school in Kenya, it was all this formalized thing. And she went to, they had these retreats, these sort of princess retreats they were called. And they had a chart of like, you could go this far before marriage and that would diminish you from a China cup to like a ceramic mug. And then if you went this far, then you became like something else. And then you were like a discarded styrofoam cup or whatever.
With and ashes that, and
like your coffee grounds in trash it. Yeah. Or whatever. And what was so sad for her was that she was later sexually assaulted in college, and she said that she just had images of these cups. It's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah. So, and probably blamed herself.
And then she was policed at RVA too. She included an incident of where her boyfriend, you know, just someone reported that there's very strict rules about dating at my school. And, her boyfriend was seen like putting his arm around something like that. Nothing too, just something very innocuous. And someone reported them. They were hauled into the administrative officials to talk. And they, you know, they talked to them both for a little while and then they let him go. And then they proceeded to just ream her, for much longer than that. And they were, and they were both male teachers as well. So, doing that. So yeah, all of that, all the good white evangelical stuff made it all the way over to around the world.
Right. Now, Christianity is doing really well in the global South, far better than it's doing, frankly, in Europe and the United States, which raises the question of, you know, why are missionaries needed? At this point.
Well, that's why are American missionaries specifically? Yeah.
White evangelical American missionaries.
I mean, that is the question, Mona, right? That's kind of the central question that people want to sort of ask. And I will say the face of missions is changing or has been changing for probably a couple of decades now, maybe 20, 25 years, 30 years now, whereas more missionaries are going out from other countries and to different places, and American missionaries are working more sort of in partnership or whatever with local people. But still, and I talked to some African missiologists about this, and to make sure I wasn't just dreaming this up myself, and they agreed that so about half of all the missionaries in the world are still American. So the U.S. is by far the number one mission sending country. But more importantly, the study of missions, the literature of missions, a lot of even global evangelical theology writ large is American centric. And what you have now at this point, after again, American evangelicals and all of their products, by the way, the books, the movies, it's a whole consumer universe. Has been their style of worship, even the songs, all of that has been exported in a huge way since the 1970s. So global evangelicalism is so heavily influenced by specifically white American evangelical theology and culture and sort of products that it's kind of hard to distinguish the two. So you see global evangelicalism taking off, and you see more global Christians being part of missions and doing those missions, but they have all been brought up in this whole system. And now you see what I call like a boomerang of where now you see some Africans in particular coming in, and you know, they've tweaked the theology, is a little bit tweaked or amped up in certain ways, and then they're coming back into America and sort of fueling American evangelical pockets of American evangelicalism here. For instance, the National Apostolic Reformation, one of the more extreme fringe movements that's part of the MAGA universe, you know, they have several African prophets. You know, there's a lot of if you notice, like in the MAGA universe, a lot of the sort of Black Christians or people of color in those religious spaces and on Trump's sort of little team of evangelical leaders, a lot of them are actually not American. There's that West African nurse, I forget where she's from, who's one of the big anti-vaxxers, for instance. Yeah. It's hard to chart out cultural influence, and it's a very nebulous thing. But I really see the impact of American evangelicalism globally, even as the face of evangelicalism globally changes.
Without playing shrink too much, but a little bit, just a little bit of playing shrink. I mean, these are people who are imbued with religious faith. They genuinely think that they are saving people's souls from eternal damnation. Mm-hmm. They believe that. And that's really, that's a big deal. You can save somebody's soul from eternal damnation, right? That's a good thing. But how do they, how do they square their religious fervor with, for example, their attitudes toward, so they're going abroad to help people who are in poverty and who have all kinds of privation, and as they would see it, they are spiritually ignorant, you know, and need to be enlightened. And yet, when it comes to things like helping refugees in this country, I think the data show that the group that is the least sympathetic are white evangelicals.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very telling fact. Now, I know evangelicals who do help refugees here in America, and then they vote for Donald Trump. So there's that too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's very telling. Again, I think that, it's about control ultimately, and they would rather engage, I think, a lot. And again, broad brush, there's a lot of good people doing good work. But American white evangelical Americans as a whole, as a culture, would rather engage in these issues from a place of power and control. And when you go overseas and you're the privileged, you know, sort of Americans, and everybody's looking to you and deferring to you, that's quite an ego boost. And you basically have the control of the situation, and you're the heroes of that narrative. Here in America, it's not, especially as white evangelical influence wanes and numbers wane. I mean, now it's to the point that so many evangelical kids are leaving the faith. They can't even control their own children anymore, you know? And then you have, you know, again, people of color who are out protesting racial injustice in the streets, and you have, you know, again, waning, what you see as waning political power, which, and cultural power, and that you feel like the culture is leaving you. And so I think that I think that's the appeal of authoritarianism writ large for white evangelicals. And, you know, there's always been a nationalistic strain in that. And so I think being anti-immigrant and anti-refugee sort of comes with that territory.
Yeah, you argue, I
that the evangelical missionary impulse is all tied up with the sort of worshiping of America too, right? And that that America itself has a special role. God needs Americans to be doing this. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, that goes way back, of course, in our history. And, you know, in a secular, in the secular realm, I don't know if I would say I'm completely on board with, but I'm certainly can agree to some extent with the American exceptionalism narrative. In a geopolitical sense, you know, this is an indispensable nation, and I feel like our leadership in the world is important. It's our power is indisputable, and so therefore, it's a question of like, well, how do we use it, you know, as a nation? But that's in the secular realm. I think when you get into the religious realm, and when you're trying to build, you know, a faith that is global and rooted in, you know, the values of the gospel, which are, you know, champion the marginalized and are about, you know, justice and liberation and all of those and all of those things. You know, it's problematic to have a religious narrative in which your country or your kind or your people are somehow above or better or special than everyone else. And so I find that problematic to on a religious level, but it's certainly been there from the beginning. Manifest Destiny, you know, the winning the West, converting Native Americans, you know, that was one of the early mission fields. They sent missionaries to all these Native American tribes and like deliberately tried to wipe out their entire culture. It was a campaign of cultural annihilation, sending people around the world. Again, there's a genuine, earnest spiritual element to that, believing that people are going to hell and you want to save them. But there's a cultural element too, you know, spreading Western or hoping to spread Western values, even economy, even economic values. And again, I'm a big fan of capitalism, big fan. Think it's the only thing we found that really promotes growth. But when you're spiritualizing that, I think that becomes problematic.
Yeah. So did you ever like rub elbows with or come into contact with or even hear anything about other religious groups growing up? Did you hear about like the Catholics and the Mormons?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe the Mormons have a big missionary program. What was that like?
Well, I certainly heard about other Christians, including the type that I am now of, the liberal mainline,
the dreaded mainline
Christians, Catholics, certainly Mormons, that none of those are real Christians, that only the evangelical type, and really, again, loaded with cultural baggage, that unexamined cultural baggage. Really, it's if you really want to go back and get specific, it's derived from Southern Christianity. American Southern Christianity is basically, you can draw a pretty straight line to what is now white evangelicalism writ large. They've shed some of the racial baggage. Well, they've externally shed some of the racial baggage, but theologically, a lot of the theological elements are the same. So that was the only kind of Christianity. So on the mission field, you know, we would encounter Christians of other types. I remember our house worker went to a Presbyterian church, and my parents were concerned that she wasn't a real Christian. But then after getting to know her, then they decided she would qualify as a real Christian, but that was not a given that she, and she was very devout. She was in church all the time, you know, very devout Christian. Of course, American evangelicals have been sending missionaries to Latin America and predominantly Catholic countries for a long, long time.
Very successfully.
Catholics definitely do not qualify as Christian.
They're not.
And then
Christians.
In Kenya,
okay.
You know, we had other religions, and there was a little bit of a curiosity about that. I remember my school, we took a tour my senior year of, we went to a Hindu temple and a Sikh temple and a mosque. There's in Kenya, there's particularly quite a few, a large minority of Muslims in Kenya. And we went to the mosque, but it was a more of a, the, we did not go to a synagogue. There are a few Jews in Kenya. There's a lot in South Africa. But I didn't go to a synagogue. And I never saw a synagogue growing up.
I think there's a growing Jewish community in Nairobi now.
Oh, that's, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, these cities in Africa are now becoming, you know, very cosmopolitan and representing a lot of different people. Yeah. But anyway, the visiting these other faiths, the point was never like learn about them or learn from them. It was like, you need to know this so that you can convert people. And that was really the impulse behind it. So there's an implicit, I don't doubt people's sincere, you know, care for humanity that they sincerely believe is going to hell. But it packaged in that there's an implicit superiority complex. I mean, the whole reason why we're here, you know, is to save you, to show you that you're wrong. I mean, it's hard to escape the sort of arrogance in that, even if it's also an earnestness, you know?
Obviously, you want people to buy your book. But what is the one reason, the most important reason that you think people should understand the role of missions in the evangelical world?
Yeah. So I actually did not write this book because I thought everybody should understand missionary kids because we're so interesting, or, you know, or even missions themselves. I did not write this book to, you know, give a grade to sort of American missions. I wrote this book because I think missions is absolutely central to building the white evangelical narrative over the centuries that has landed us in this place where they are fueling an authoritarian movement. And I think missionary kids are really great sources for that. They have kind of an insider-outsider status, both for missions themselves and for American Christianity and American culture writ large. That makes them really interesting sources. So I really wanted to use the experiences, my experience and the experiences of my cohort of missionary kids as a way, as an interesting, hopefully an interesting way, because we are kind of exotic creatures, right? Yeah. As an interesting way of exploring, you know, this narrative that is really, has really come home to roost in our politics. And, you know, it's not a direct link. Like most missionaries I know now, and maybe even in the past, you know, they aren't MAGA. Like they don't buy into this and they think they're focused on the work that they're doing wherever. But the American church uses their story to build this sense of identity and has done that for a couple of centuries. So the missionaries themselves and their experience and their work are one thing, but then the missionary narrative, how they are used and how they're sort of the poster children and how they fuel evangelical self-concept. I felt like that's really the more relevant story to our current situation.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. The book again is The Missionary Kids, Unmasking the Myths of White Evangelicalism. Holly Berkeley Fletcher, I forgot to say you're also a PhD in history. Thank you so much.
I am, way long time ago.
Thanks so much for joining me and for writing this great book.
Thank you, Mona. It's a pleasure.